Cinder. Go play lab rat for these deranged scientists, Cinder. Yes, I understand you perfectly. She glanced back over her shoulder, but Aiko had ducked back into the kitchen. As I'm sure you will understand that I just lost half a day of perfectly good work hours, and I'd better borrow your serve 9.2 to get caught up. You don't mind, do you? Without waiting for a response, she stormed back to her closet of a bedroom and slammed the door behind her. She stood with her back against the door until the warning text on her retina had gone away and her hands stopped shaking. When she opened her eyes, she found that the old net screen, the one Audrey had shoved off the wall, had been heaped on the pile of blankets she called a bed. Bits of plastic had spilled over onto her pillow. She hadn't noticed if Audrey had already bought them a new one or if the living room wall was empty. Sighing, she changed her clothes, eager to be rid of the smell of antiseptic that lingered on them. She shoved the spare plastic pieces into her toolbox and tucked the screen beneath one arm before venturing back out into the apartment. Aiko hadn't moved, half hidden in the kitchen doorway. Cinder cocked her head toward the front of the apartment, and the android followed. She did not look into the living room as she passed, but she thought she heard the strangled sound of Prince Kai dying from Pearl's game. They had barely stepped out of the main corridor, fairly quiet for once with the neighbor children off at school, when Aiko wrapped her gangly arms around Cinder's legs.
How is this possible? I was sure you'd be killed. What happened?
Cinder handed the toolbox to the robot and headed for the elevators.
I'll tell you everything, but we have work to do.
She waited until they were alone and on their way to the basement before filling Aiko in on all that had happened, leaving out only the part about Prince Kai coming in and finding her unconscious on the floor.
You mean you have to go back?
Said Aiko as they stepped out into the basement. Yes, but it's fine. The doctor said I'm not in any danger now. Plus, they're going to pay me, and Audrey won't know about it.
How much?
I'm not sure, but a lot, I think.
Aiko grabbed Cinder's wrist just as Cinder opened the chicken wire door to her workroom.
You realize what this means?
Cinder held the door open with her foot.
Which part? It means you can afford a pretty dress, prettier than Pearl's. You can go to the ball, and Audrey won't be able to say anything to stop you.
Cinder pressed her lips together like she'd just bitten a lemon and pulled her wrist from Aiko's grip. Really, Aiko? She said, examining her mess of tools and spare parts.
You really think Audrey's gonna let me go now just because I can buy my own dress? She would probably tear it off me and try to resell the buttons. Well, fine. We won't tell her about the dress or about going to the ball. You don't have to go with them. You're better than them. You're valuable.
Aiko's fan was whirring like mad, as if her processor could barely keep up with all these revelations.
Immune to letamosis. My stars, you could be a celebrity because of this.
Cinder ignored her, stooping to prop the net screen against the shelving unit. Her gaze had landed on a pile of silver fabric crumpled in the far corner, barely shimmering in the dusty light.
What's that?
Aiko's fan calmed to a slow hum.
Peony's ball gown? I couldn't bring myself to throw it away. I didn't think anyone would ever come down here again, what with you. So I just thought I'd keep it, for myself.
That was bad, Aiko. It could have been infected.
Cinder hesitated only for a moment before walking to the dress and picking it up by the pearl-dotted sleeves. It was smudged with dirt and covered in wrinkles, and there was a chance it had been exposed to letamosis. But the doctor had said the disease wouldn't survive long on clothing. Besides, nobody was ever going to wear it now. She draped the gown over the welder and turned away.
We're not using this money on a dress, she said. We're still not going to the ball.
Why not?
Aiko said, a distinct whine in her robotic voice. Approaching her desk, Cinder swung her leg up and started unloading the stashed tools from her calf.
You remember that car we saw at the junkyard? The old gasoline one? Aiko's speakers made a coarse, grumbling noise, the closest she could get to a groan.
What about it?
It's going to take all our time and money to fix it up.
No, Cinder, tell me you're joking.
Cinder was recording a mental list as she shut the storage compartment and rolled down her pant leg. The words scrolled across her vision. Get car, assess condition, find parts, download wiring blueprint, order gasoline. She spotted Kai's android on her work table. Fix android. I am serious. She pulled her hair back into its tight ponytail, strangely excited. Marching to the standing toolbox in the corner, she started fishing for things that might come in handy. Bungee cords and chains, rags and generators, anything to help get that car cleaned up and ready for fixing. We're going to go back tonight. Get it to the parking garage if we can, otherwise we might have to fix it at the yard. Now, I need to go back to the palace tomorrow morning and take a look at the prince's android tomorrow afternoon, but if we're diligent, I think I could have it fixed in a couple weeks, maybe less, depending on what it needs, of course.
But why? Why are we fixing it?
Cinder shoved the tools into her messenger bag. Because that car is going to get us out of here. Chapter 16. Night shift nurses and androids plastered themselves to the walls as Prince Kai barreled through the corridor. He had run all the way from his bedroom on the 16th floor of the palace's private wing, pausing to catch his breath only when he was forced to wait for the elevator. He burst through the door to the visiting room and came to a halt all at once, still gripping the door's handle. His mad eyes found Torin, arms crossed as he leaned against the far wall. The advisor tore his gaze from the glass window and met Kai's panicked expression with one of resignation. I heard, Kai started, pulling back his shoulders. Wetting his dry mouth, he came into the room. The door clicked behind him. The small sitting room was lit only by a table lamp and the bright fluorescence in the quarantine. Kai peered into the sick room just as a medroid pulled a white cloth over his father's closed eyes. His hammering heart plummeted.
I'm too late.
Torin stirred.
It happened only minutes ago, he said,
forcing himself away from the wall. Kai took in the advisor's lined face and sleepless eyes, and a cup of untouched tea that sat beside his port screen. He'd stayed late to work, rather than return to his own home, his own bed. The exhaustion caught up to Kai all at once, and he pressed his burning forehead against the cool glass.
He should have been there too. I will set up a press conference.
Torin's voice was hollow.
A press conference? The country needs to know. We will mourn together.
Torin seemed shaken for a rare moment. He covered it with a measured breath. Kai squeezed his eyes shut and chafed them with his fingers. Even knowing that it was coming, that his father was sick with this incurable disease, it still made no sense. All that had just been lost, taken so quickly. Not just his father, not just the emperor. His youth, his freedom.
You will be a good emperor, said Torin, as he was.
Kai flinched away from him. He did not want to think about it, all of his own inadequacies. He was too young, too stupid, too optimistic, too naive. He couldn't do this. The screen behind them pinged, followed by a sweetly feminine voice. Incoming communication for Crown Prince Kaito of the Eastern Commonwealth from Queen Lavanna of Luna. Kai spun toward the net screen, blank but for a spinning globe in the corner, signaling unavailable calm. Any thread of tears vanished into an oncoming headache. The air thickened, but neither of them moved.
How could she know? So soon, said Kai. She must have spies.
From the corner of his eye, he saw Torin level a glare at him. A warning not to start in on the conspiracy theories just yet.
Perhaps the thaumaturge or her guard saw you, he said. running through the castle in the middle of the night. What else could it mean?
Locking his jaw, Kai drew himself to his full height, hailing the screen like an enemy.
I guess our mourning period is over, he murmured.
Screen, accept calm.
The screen brightened. Kai bristled at the sight of the Lunar Queen, her head and shoulders draped in an ornate cream-colored veil, like a perpetual bride. All that could be seen beneath the shroud was a hint of long dark hair and the ghost of her features. The explanation told by the Lunars was that their queen's beauty was a gift not to be seen by undeserving Earthens. But Kai had heard that in reality, the queen's glamour, her ability to make people see her as divinely beautiful by manipulating their brainwaves, could not translate over the net screens. Therefore, she never allowed herself to be seen over them. Whatever the reason, looking at the white-swathed figure for too long always made Kai's eyes sting.
My dear Prince Regent, Levana said in a saccharine voice, may I be the first to offer my condolences on the loss of your father, the good Emperor Raikin. May he forever rest in peace.
Kai cast a cool glare at Torin.
Spies?
Torin did not return the look.
Though the occasion is tragic, I do look forward to continuing the talk of an alliance with you as the new leader of Earth's Eastern Commonwealth. As I see no reason to defer these conversations until your coronation, whensoever that shall be, I do think it's appropriate to plan a meeting as soon as is convenient in your time of mourning. My shuttle is prepared. I can depart as soon as your next sunrise and come to offer both my sympathies and my congratulations in the flesh. I will alert my thaumaturge to expect my arrival. She can ensure that accommodations are adequately prepared. I ask that you do not concern yourself with my comfort. I am sure you will have many other concerns during this tragic time. My sympathies are with you and the Commonwealth.
She finished her message with a tilt of her head, and the screen blackened. Jaw hanging, Kai faced Torin. He squeezed his fists against his side before they could start to shake.
She wants to come here? Now? It hasn't even been 15 minutes!
Torin cleared his throat.
We should discuss this in the morning, before the press conference, I suppose.
Kai turned away, thunking his head against the window. Beyond the glass, the peaks of his father's body were obscured beneath the white sheet, not unlike the queen and her veil. The emperor had lost so much weight in the past weeks that his form seemed more like a mannequin's than a man's. His father was no longer there, unable to protect Kai, unable to offer advice, unable to lead his country ever again.
She thinks I'm weak, Kai said. She's going to try and persuade me to accept the marriage alliance now, while everything is in chaos.
He kicked the wall, biting back a cry of pain when he remembered he wasn't wearing shoes.
Can't we tell her no? Tell her she's not welcome here? I'm not sure that would be the indication of peace your father had been striving for. She's the one who's been threatening war for the last 12 years!
Torin pursed his lips, and the haunting worry in his gaze quelled Kai's anger.
Discussions must go two ways, Your Highness. We will listen to her requests, but she must listen to ours as well.
Kai's shoulders drooped. He turned around, craning his head back and staring at the shadowed ceiling. What did she mean, her thaumaturge will prepare her accommodations?
Removing the mirrors, I suspect.
Kai squeezed his eyes shut.
Mirrors. Right, I forgot.
He massaged his forehead.
What was it about the Lunars? And not just any Lunar, Queen Levana. On Earth, in his country, his home.
He shivered. The people aren't going to like this.
No, Torin sighed. Tomorrow will be a dark day for the Commonwealth.
Chapter 17. A ping darted through Cinder's head, followed by a message scrolled across the blackness of sleep. Comm received from New Beijing District 29. Letemosis quarantine. Lin, Peony, entered third stage of Letemosis at 4:57 on 22 August 126 TE. It took a minute to shake off the grogginess of sleep and make sense of the scrawling words. She opened her eyes to the windowless bedroom and sat up. All her muscles ached from the midnight trip to the junkyard. Her back hurt so bad it felt as though that old car had run over her, rather than sat in neutral while she and Aiko pushed and pulled it through the back roads. But they had succeeded. The car was hers, moved to a dark corner of the apartment's underground parking garage, where she'd be able to work on it every spare moment. As long as no one complained about the smell, it would remain her and Aiko's little secret. When they'd finally returned home, Cinder had crashed like someone had hit her power button. For once, she'd had no nightmares. At least, no nightmares until the message woke her. The thought of Peony all alone in the quarantines spurred her out of her pile of blankets with a stifled groan. She pulled on a pair of gloves, stole a green brocade blanket from the linen closet in the hall, and passed Aiko, set to conservation mode and connected to a charging station in the living room. It felt strange leaving without the android, but she planned on going straight to the palace afterward. In the apartment corridor, she could hear someone pacing on the next floor, and a net screen mumbling the morning news. Cinder calmed a hover for the first time in her life, and it was ready for her by the time she got down to the street. She scanned her ID and gave it the quarantine's coordinates before settling into the far back. Cinder netlinked so she could trace the hover's path to the quarantine. The map that overlaid her vision indicated it was in the industrial district, 15 miles outside the city limits. The city was all shadows, blurry, sleepy apartments and empty sidewalks. The buildings grew shorter, with more space between them as the heart of the city was left behind. Pale sunlight crawled down the streets, sending long shadows across the pavement. Cinder knew they'd reached the industrial district without the map's help. She blinked it away and watched the factories roll by alongside squat concrete warehouses with gigantic roll-up doors that could accommodate even the largest hover, probably even cargo ships. Cinder scanned her ID as she exited so the hover could debit her nearly depleted account, then ordered it to wait for her. She headed toward the nearest warehouse where a group of androids stood by the door. Above the door was a brand new net screen flashing, Letemosis quarantine, patients and androids only beyond this point. She draped the blanket over her forearms and tried to look confident as she walked, wondering what she would say if the androids questioned her. But the medroids must not have been programmed to deal with healthy people coming into the quarantines. They hardly even noticed her as she passed. She hoped it would be as easy to leave. Perhaps she should have asked Dr. Erland for a pass. The stench of excrement and rot reached out to her as she stepped into the warehouse. She reeled back, cupping her palm over her nose as her stomach churned, wishing her brain interface could dull odors as easily as it could noise. Sucking in a breath through her glove and holding it, she forced herself into the warehouse. It was cooler inside, the concrete floor untouched by the sun. Opaque green plastic covered a thin row of windows near the high ceilings, swathing the building in a dingy haze. Gray light bulbs hummed overhead, but they did little to dispel the darkness. Hundreds of beds were lined up between the distant walls, covered in mismatched blankets, donations, and scraps. She was glad to have brought a nice one for Peony. Most of the beds sat empty. This quarantine had been hastily constructed in just the past weeks as the sickness crept closer to the city. Still, the flies had already caught on and filled the room with buzzing. The few patients Cinder passed were sleeping or staring blankly up at the ceiling, their skin covered in a blue-black rash, Those who still had their senses were hunkered over port screens, their last connection to the outside world. Glossy eyes looked up, following Cinder as she hurried by. More medroids moved between the beds, supplying food and water, but none of them stopped Cinder. She found Peony asleep, tangled in a baby blue blanket. Cinder wasn't sure she would have recognized her if it hadn't been for the chestnut curls draped over the pillow. The purplish blotches had spread up her arms. Though she was shivering, her forehead glistened with sweat. She looked like an old woman, just this side of death. Cinder removed her glove and placed the back of her hand against Peony's forehead. Warm to the touch and damp. The third stage of letimosis. She spread the green blanket over Peony, then stood, wondering if she should wake her, or if it was better to let her rest. Rocking back on her heels, she looked around. The bed behind her was empty. The one on the opposite side of Peony was occupied by a petite form turned away from her, curled in a fetal position. A child. Cinder started as she felt a tug on her left wrist. Peony was gripping her steel fingers, squeezing with the little strength she had left. Her eyes watched Cinder, pleading, afraid, awed, as if Peony were seeing a ghost. Cinder swallowed hard and sat down on the bed. It was almost as hard as the floor in her own bedroom.
"Take me home," Peony said, her voice scratching at the words.
Cinder flinched. She covered Peony's hand.
"I brought you a blanket," she said, as if it explained her presence.
Peony's gaze fell from her. Her free hand traced the texture of the brocade. They said nothing for a long time, until a shrill scream reached them. Peony's hands clenched as Cinder spun around, searching, sure someone was being murdered. A woman four aisles away was thrashing in her bed, screeching, begging to be left alone as a calm medroid waited to inject her with a syringe. A minute later, two more androids arrived to hold the woman still, forcing her down on the bed, holding her arm out to receive the shot. Feeling Peony curl up beside her, Cinder turned back. Peony was shaking.
"I'm being punished for something," Peony said, shutting her eyes.
"Don't be ridiculous," Cinder said. "The plague, it isn't fair, I know, but you didn't do anything wrong." She patted the girl's hand.
"Our mom and Pearl..."
"Heartbroken," said Cinder. "We all miss you so much, but they haven't caught it." Peony's eyes flickered open. She scanned Cinder's face, her neck.
"Where are your spots?"
Lips parting, Cinder rubbed absently at her throat, but Peony didn't wait for an answer.
"You can sleep there, right?" she said, gesturing to the empty bed. "They won't give you a bed far away."
Cinder squeezed Peony's hands.
"No, Peony, I'm not..."
She looked around, but no one was paying them any attention. A medroid two beds away was helping a patient take a drink of water.
"I'm not sick."
Peony lifted her head.
"You're here."
"I know, it's complicated. You see, I went to the Letimosis Research Center yesterday, and they tested me, and... Peony, I'm immune. I can't get Letimosis." Peony's tense brow melted. She scanned Cinder's face, neck, arms again, as if her immunity were something visible, something that should have been apparent.
"Immune?"
Cinder rubbed Peony's hand more quickly, anxious now that she'd told someone her secret.
"They asked me to go back again today. The head doctor thinks he might be able to use me to find an antidote. I told him that if he finds anything, anything at all, you have to be the first person to get it. I made him promise."
She watched, amazed, as Peony's eyes began to fill with tears.
"Really?"
"Absolutely. We're going to find one."
"How long will it take?"
I'm not sure." Peony's other hand found her wrist and squeezed. Her long nails dug into Cinder's arm. but it took her a long time to register the pain. Peony's breath had grown rapid. More tears pooled in her eyes, but some of the instant hope had faded, leaving her wild with desperation.
"Don't let me die, Cinder. I want to go to the ball. Remember, you are going to introduce me to Prince."
She turned her head, scrunching her face up in a vain attempt to hold in the tears, or hide them, or squeeze them out faster. Then, a harsh cough burst from her mouth, along with a thin trail of blood. Cinder grimaced, then reached forward and swiped the blood off Peony's chin with the corner of the brocade blanket.
"Don't give up, Peony. If I'm immune, then there has to be a way to defeat it. And they're going to find it. You're still going to the ball."
She considered telling Peony that Aiko had managed to save her dress, but realized that would require telling her that everything else she'd ever touched was gone. She cleared her throat and stroked Peony's hair off her temple.
"Is there anything I can do to make you more comfortable?"
Peony shook her head against the worn pillow, holding the blanket against her mouth. But then she raised her eyes.
"My port screen?"
Cinder flinched with guilt.
"I'm sorry. It's still broken, but I'll look at it tonight. I just want a calm pearl. And Mom..."
"Of course, I'll bring it to you as soon as I can."
Peony's port screen, the prince's android, the car.
"I'm so sorry, Peony, but I need to go."
The small hands tightened.
"I'll be back as soon as I can, I promise."
Peony took in a shaky breath, sniffed, then released her. She dug her frail hands beneath the blanket, burying herself up to her chin. Cinder stood and untangled Peony's hair with her fingers.
"Try to get some sleep. Reserve your strength."
Peony followed Cinder with her watery gaze.
"I love you, Cinder. I'm glad you're not sick."
Cinder's heart tightened. Pursing her lips, she bent over and placed a kiss against Peony's damp forehead.
"I love you too."
She struggled to breathe as she forced herself to walk away, trying to trick herself into being hopeful.
There was a chance. A chance.
She didn't look at any of the other patients as she made her way to the quarantine's exit. But then she heard her name. She paused, thinking that the sandpaper voice had been nothing more than her imagination mixed with too many hysterical cries.
"Cinder!"
She turned and spotted a familiar face, half covered by an age-bleached quilt.
"Chang Zhe?"
She neared the foot of the bed, nose wrinkling at the pungent odor wafting from the woman's bed. Chang Sasha, the market baker, was barely recognizable with her swollen eyelids and sallow skin. Trying to breathe normally, Cinder rounded the bed. The quilt that rested across Sasha's nose and mouth shifted with her belabored breathing. Her eyes were glossy, as wide as Cinder had ever seen them. It was the only time she could remember Sasha looking at her without disdain.
"You too, Cinder."
Instead of answering, Cinder said uncertainly,
"Can I do anything for you?"
They were the kindest words that had ever passed between them. The blanket shifted, inching down Sasha's face. Cinder bit back a gasp at seeing the blue-ringed splotches on the woman's jaw and down her throat.
"My son,"
she said, wheezing each word.
"Bring Sundo. I need to see him."
Cinder didn't move, remembering how Sasha had ordered Sundo away from her booth days before.
"Bring him?"
Sasha snaked one arm out from beneath the blankets and reached toward Cinder, grasping her wrist where skin met metal. Cinder squirmed, trying to pull away, but Sasha held tight. Her hand was marked by bluish pigment around her yellowed fingernails. The fourth and final stage of the blue fever.
"I will try," she said.
She reached up, hesitated, then pet Sasha on the knuckles. The blue fingers released her and sank to the bed.
Sundo,
Sasha murmured. Her gaze was still locked on Cinder's face, but the recognition had faded.
Sundo.
Cinder stepped back, watching as the words dried up, the life dulled in Sasha's black eyes. Cinder convulsed, tying her arms around her stomach. She looked around. None of the other patients were paying any attention to her or the woman, the corpse, beside her. But then she saw the android rolling toward them. The medroids must be linked somehow, she thought, to know when someone dies. How long did it take for the notification comm to be sent to the family? How long would it be before Sunto knew he was motherless? She wanted to turn away, to leave, but she felt rooted to the spot as the android wheeled up beside the bed and took Sasha's limp hand between its grippers. Sasha's complexion was ashen, but for the bruised blotches on her jaw. Her eyes were still open, turned toward the heavens. Perhaps the medroid would have questions for Cinder. Perhaps someone would want to know the woman's final words. Her son might want to know. Cinder should tell someone. But the medroid sensor did not turn toward her. Cinder licked her lips. She opened her mouth, but could think of nothing to say. A panel opened in the body of the medroid. It reached in with its free prongs and pulled out a scalpel. Cinder watched, mesmerized and disgusted, as the android pressed the blade into Sasha's wrist. A stream of blood dripped down Sasha's palm. Cinder shook herself from her stupor and stumbled forward. The foot of the bed pressed into her thighs. "What are you doing?" she said, louder than she'd meant to. The medroid paused with the scalpel buried in Sasha's flesh. Its yellow visor flashed toward Cinder, then dimmed. "How can I help you?" it said with its manufactured politeness. "What are you doing to her?" she asked again. She wanted to reach out and snatch the scalpel away, but feared she misunderstood. There must be a reason. Something logical. Medroids were all logic. "Removing her ID chip," said the android. "Why?" The visor flashed again, and the android returned its focus to Sasha's wrist. "She has no more use for it." The medroid traded the scalpel for tweezers, and Cinder heard the subtle click of metal on metal. She grimaced as the android extracted the small chip. Its protective plastic coating glistened scarlet. "But don't you need it to identify the body?" The android dropped the chip into a tray that opened up in its plastic plating. Cinder saw it fall into a bed of dozens of other bloodied chips. It drew the tattered blanket over Sasha's unblinking eyes. Instead of answering her question, it said simply, "I have been programmed to follow instructions." Chapter 18. A medroid rolled into Cinder's path as she exited the warehouse, blocking her way with outstretched, spindly arms. "Patients are strictly forbidden from leaving the quarantine area," it said, nudging Cinder back into the shadows of the doorway. Cinder swallowed her panic and halted the robot with a palm against its smooth forehead. "I'm not a patient," she said. "I'm not even sick. Here." She held out her elbow, displaying a small bruise from being stuck with too many needles the past 2 days. The android's innards hummed as it processed her statement, searching its database for a logical reaction. Then, a panel opened in its torso, and the third arm, the syringe arm, extended toward Cinder. She flinched, her skin tender, but tried to relax as the android drew a fresh sample of blood. The syringe disappeared into the android's body, and Cinder waited, rolling her sleeve down over the hem of her glove. The test seemed to take longer than at the junkyard, and a sinking panic was crawling up Cinder's spine. What if Dr. Erland had been wrong? When she heard a low beep and the android backed away, clearing her path. She released her breath and did not look back at the robot or any of its companions as she crossed the hot asphalt. The hover was still waiting for her. Settling into the back seat, She told it to take her to New Beijing Palace. Having been unconscious the first time she'd been brought to the palace, Cinder found herself plastered to the hover's window as she was taken up the steep, winding road to the top of the harsh cliffs that bordered the city. Her netlink fished for information, telling her that the palace had been built after World War IV, when the city was little more than rubble. It was designed in the fashion of the old world, with hearty dosages of both nostalgic symbolism and state-of-the-art engineering. The pagoda-style roofs were made of gold-tinged tiles and surrounded by Killin gargoyles, but the tiles were actually galvanized steel covered with tiny solar capsules that created enough energy to sustain the entire palace, including the research wing. And the gargoyles were equipped with motion sensors, ID scanners, 360-degree cameras, and radars that could detect approaching aircrafts and hovers within a 60-mile radius. All that was invisible, though, the technology hidden in the ornately carved beams and tiered pavilions. What captured Cinder's eye was not modern technology, but a cobblestoned road lined with cherry blossom trees. Bamboo screens framing the garden entrances. Through a peep window, a steadily trickling stream. The hover did not stop at the main entrance, with its crimson pergolas. Instead, it rounded to the northern side of the palace, nearest the research wing. Though this part of the palace was more modern, less nostalgic, Cinder still noticed a squat Buddha sculpture with a cheery face off the pathway. As she paid for the hover and walked toward the automatic glass door, a subtle pulse tugged at her ankle. Buddha scanning visitors for weapons. To her relief, the steel in her leg did not set off any alarms. Inside, she was greeted by an android who asked for her name and told her to wait in the elevator bank. The research center was a hive of activity. Diplomats and doctors, ambassadors and androids, all roaming the halls on their separate missions. An elevator opened and Cinder stepped into it, glad to be alone. The doors began to close, but then paused and opened again. "Please hold," said the mechanical voice of the elevator operator. A moment later, Prince Kai darted through the half-open doors.
Sorry, thanks for hold."
He saw her and froze.
"Lin Mei?"
Cinder pushed herself off the elevator wall and fell into the most natural bow she could, simultaneously checking that her left glove was pulled up over her wrist.
"Your Highness!"
The words were a rush, spit out automatically, and she felt the need to say something more to fill the space of the elevator, but nothing came. The doors closed, the box began to rise. She cleared her throat.
"You should, just call me Cinder. You don't have to be so...
diplomatic." The corner of the prince's lip quirked, but the almost smile didn't reach his eyes. "All right. Cinder, are you following me?" She frowned, hackles rising before she realized he was teasing her.
"I'm just going to check on the Medroid that I looked at yesterday, to ensure it doesn't have any remaining bugs or anything."
He nodded, but Cinder detected a shadow lingering behind his eyes, a new stiffness to his shoulders. "I was on my way to talk to Dr. Erland about his progress. I heard through the grapevine that he may have made progress with one of the recent draft subjects. I don't suppose he said anything to you?"
Cinder fidgeted with her belt loops.
"No, he didn't mention anything, but I'm just the mechanic." The elevator came to a stop. Kai gestured for her to exit first, and then joined her as they made their way to the laboratories. She watched the white floor pass beneath her feet.
"Your Highness?" interrupted a youngish woman with black hair that hung in a tight braid.
Her gaze was fixed on Prince Kai, all sympathy.
"I'm so sorry."
Cinder's gaze shifted to Kai, who tipped his head at the woman.
"Thank you, Fatim,"
and kept walking. Cinder frowned. Not a dozen steps later, they were halted again by a man carrying a handful of clear vials in his fists.
"My condolences, Your Highness."
Cinder shivered as her feet came to a pause beneath her.
Kai stopped and peered back at her. You haven't seen the net this morning. A heartbeat later, Cinder was accessing her netlink, pages flashing across her eyesight. The EC news page, a half dozen pictures of Emperor Riken, two pictures of Kai, the Prince Regent. She clapped a hand to her mouth. Kai seemed surprised, but the look quickly faded. He ducked his head, his black bangs falling into his eyes. Good guess.
I'm so sorry. I didn't know.
He tucked his hands into his pockets and gazed down the hallway. Only now did Cinder notice the faint rim of red around his eyes.
I wish my father's death were the worst of it.
Your Highness? Her netlink was still scanning for information, but nothing seemed worse than Emperor Riken having passed away last night. The only other noteworthy tidbit was that Prince Kai's coronation had been scheduled for the same evening of the Peace Festival, to take place before the ball. He met her gaze, surprised, as if he'd forgotten who he was speaking with. Then,
you can call me Kai.
She blinked.
Excuse me?
No more Your Highness. I get enough of that from everyone else. You should just call me Kai.
No, that would be...
Don't make me turn it into a royal command, he hinted at a smile.
Cinder scrunched her shoulders up by her ears, suddenly embarrassed.
All right, I suppose.
Thank you. He cocked his head toward the hall. We should go then.
She had nearly forgotten that they were in the research hall, surrounded by people, everyone politely ignoring them as if they were not even there. She started down the hallway, wondering if she'd spoken out of place and awkward beside the prince, who was suddenly just Kai. It didn't feel right.
What was wrong with the android?
She scratched at an oil stain on her glove.
Oh, I'm sorry. She's not done yet. I'm working on her, I swear.
No, I mean the medroid that you fixed for Dr. Erland.
Oh, right. It had a dead wire between its optosensor and control panel.
Kai lifted an eyebrow, and she wasn't sure that she'd convinced him. She cleared her throat.
You said something was worse before?
When Kai said nothing for an awkward moment, she shrugged.
Never mind, I didn't mean to pry.
No, it's all right. You'll find out soon enough. He lowered his voice, inclining his head toward her as they walked.
The Lunar Queen informed us this morning that she is coming to the Commonwealth on a diplomatic mission, supposedly.
Cinder nearly tripped, but Kai kept walking. She stumbled after him.
The Lunar Queen is coming here? You can't be serious.
I wish I weren't. Every android in the palace has spent the morning taking down every reflective surface in the guest wing. It's ridiculous, like we have nothing better to do.
Reflective surfaces? I always thought that was just superstition.
Evidently not. Something about their glamour. He twirled a finger around his face, then stopped. It doesn't really matter.
When is she coming?
Today. Cinder's stomach plummeted. The Lunar Queen? Coming to New Beijing? A chill crawled down her arms.
I'll be making an announcement in half an hour.
But why would she come now, when we're in mourning?
A grim smile.
Because we're in mourning.
Kai paused. With a glance around the hallway, he inched toward Cinder, lowering his voice.
Look, I really appreciate your helping with the medroids, and I'm sure the best mechanic in the city has a million jobs to prioritize, but at the risk of sounding like a spoiled prince, could I ask that you move Nancy to the top of your list? I'm starting to get anxious about getting her back.
He hesitated.
I think I could use the moral support of my childhood tutor right now, you know?
The intensity in his eyes did not try to hide his true meaning. He wanted her to know he was lying. This had nothing to do with moral support or childhood attachments. The panic behind the prince's eyes spoke volumes. What information could that android have that was so important? And what did it have to do with the Lunar Queen?
Of course, Your Highness. Sorry, Prince Kai. I'll take a look at her as soon as I get home.
She thought she spotted gratitude hidden somewhere beneath all his worry. Kai gestured at the door beside him, labeled Dr. Dimitri Erland. He opened the door and ushered her in. Dr. Erland was sitting at a lacquered desk, poring over a screen set into the surface. When he spotted Kai, he leaped to his feet, simultaneously snatching up his wool cap and rounding the desk toward them.
Your Highness, I am so sorry. What can I do to help you?
Nothing, thank you, said Kai, a practiced reaction. Then he pulled his shoulders back, reconsidering. Find a cure.
I will, Your Highness. He pulled his hat on. Of course I will.
The conviction in the doctor's face was almost startling, but also comforting. Cinder immediately wondered if he'd found something new in the hours since she'd last seen him. She thought of Peony, alone in the quarantine. Though it was an awful thing to think, and she immediately chastised herself for it, she couldn't help it. With Emperor Riken dead, Peony was the first in line for an antidote. Kai cleared his throat.
I found your pretty new mechanic down in the lobby, and she tells me she's here to check on the med droids again.
You know, I could get you funding for some upgraded models if you require it. Cinder started at the simple word, pretty, but neither Kai nor Dr. Erland looked at her. Teetering on her feet, she scanned the room. A floor-to-ceiling window captured a perfect view of the lush palace gardens and the city beyond. Open shelves were filled with objects both familiar and unusual, new and ancient. A stack of books, not port screens, but solid paper books. Jars filled with leaves and dried flowers, jars filled with finely labeled liquids, jars filled with animal specimens and formaldehyde. A series of rocks and metals and ores, all finely labeled. It was the office of a witch doctor as much as an acclaimed royal scientist.
No, they only need a touch of maintenance, Dr. Erland was saying, lying as smoothly as he had the day before. Nothing to worry about, and I would hate to have to program a new model. Besides, if we didn't have any malfunctioning androids, what excuse would we have for asking Miss Lin back to the palace from time to time?
Cinder glared at the doctor, half mortified, but the start of a smile grew on Kai's face.
Doctor, said Kai, I heard a rumor that you've made some sort of a breakthrough in the past few days. Is it true?
Dr. Erland pulled the spectacles from his pocket and set to cleaning them with the hem of his lab coat.
My prince, you should know better than to ask after rumors like that. I hate to give you hope before I know anything concrete, but when I do have solid information, you will be the first to see the report.
He slid the glasses onto his nose. Kai tucked his hands into his pockets, seemingly satisfied.
Right. In that case, I leave you be and hope to see a report cross my desk any day now.
That could be difficult, Your Highness, considering you do not have a desk.
Kai shrugged and turned to Cinder. His eyes softened a little with a polite bow of his head.
I hope our paths will cross again.
Really? In that case, I guess I'll keep following you. She regretted the joke for half a breath before Kai laughed. A real laugh, and her chest warmed. Then the prince reached for her hand, her cyborg hand. Cinder tensed, terrified that he would feel the hard metal, even through her gloves, and yet even more afraid to pull away, lest he find it suspicious. She mentally urged the robotic limb to go soft, to be pliant, to be human, as she watched Kai lift the hand and kiss the back of it. She held her breath, overwhelmed and embarrassed. The prince released her, bowed, his hair falling into his eyes again, and left the room. Cinder stood frozen, her wired nerves humming. She heard Dr. Erland grunt in curiosity,
but the door opened again as soon as it had closed.
Gracious,
Dr. Erland muttered as Kai stepped back inside.
Pardon me, but might I have one more brief word with Lin Mei?
Dr. Erland flicked his wrist toward her.
By all means.
Kai turned to her, still in the doorway. I know this sounds like very poor timing, but trust me when I say my motives are based on self-preservation. He inhaled a sharp breath.
Would you consider being my personal guest at the ball?
The floor dissolved beneath Cinder. Her mind blanked. Surely she hadn't heard correctly. But he just stood, patient, and after a long moment, raised both his eyebrows in a mute prompt.
Excuse me?
Kai cleared his throat, stood straighter.
I assume you are going to the ball.
I don't know. I mean, no. No, I'm sorry, I'm not going to the ball.
Kai drew back, confused.
Oh, well, but maybe you would change your mind, because I am, you know...
The prince?
Not bragging, he said quickly. Just a fact.
I know, she gulped. The ball. Prince Kai was asking her to the ball. But that was the night she and Aiko would be running away if the car was fixed in time. The night she would escape. Besides, he didn't know who, what he was asking. If he knew the truth, how mortified would he be if anyone found out?
Kai shifted on his feet, casting a nervous glance toward the doctor.
I'm sorry, she stammered. Thank you, thank you, Your Highness, but I must respectfully decline.
He blinked. His eyes fell as he processed her response. Then he lifted his chin and attempted a grin that was almost painfully dejected.
No, it's all right. I understand.
Dr. Erlon leaned back against his desk.
My sincerest condolences, Your Highness. In more ways than one, it seems.
Cinder cast him a frosty glare, but he focused all his attention on cleaning his spectacles again. Kai scratched behind his neck.
It was nice to see you again, Lin Mei.
She flinched at the return of the formality and made to speak, her voice catching at apologies, explanations. But the prince didn't wait for them. The door was already shutting behind him. She snapped her jaw shut, thoughts sparking in her head. Dr. Erland clucked his tongue, and Cinder prepared to rail at him with those budding explanations. But he turned away before she could, and paced back to his seat.
What a shame you cannot blush, Miss Lin.
Chapter 19. Dr. Erland held both hands toward a chair on the other side of his desk.
Please, sit down. I only need to finish up a few notes, and then I will tell you some things I've learned since yesterday afternoon.
Cinder sat down, glad to get off her weak legs.
The prince just...
Yes, I was standing right here.
Dr. Erlon reclaimed his own seat and tapped at the screen in his desk. Cinder leaned back against the chair, gripping its arms to quell her shaking. Her mind was replaying the conversation, while her retina scanner informed her that her body was producing mass amounts of endorphins, and she should try to calm down.
What do you think he meant by his motives being based on self-preservation?
He probably doesn't want to be mauled by all the young ladies at the ball this year. You know there was nearly a stampede a couple years back.
She bit her lip. Of all the girls in the whole city, she was the most convenient. She forced these words to resonate, to stick. She was here, and she seemed to be sane, and she was a safe bet for him to ask to the ball. That was all it could be. Besides, he was in mourning. He wasn't thinking straight.
Emperor Raikin is dead, she said, snatching for anything else to think about. Indeed. Prince Kai was close to his father, you know.
She lowered her gaze to the screen Dr. Erland was hunched over. She could see only a small diagram of a human torso, surrounded by boxes of dense text. It did not appear to be hers. I would be lying, Dr. Erlon continued, if I said that I had not harbored secret hopes of finding an antidote in time to save His Majesty. Though I knew from the moment the diagnosis was made that it was unlikely. Nevertheless, we must proceed with our work. She nodded in agreement, thinking of Peony's little hand gripping hers. Doctor, why haven't you told the prince about me? Don't you want him to know that you've found someone who's immune? Isn't that important? He pressed his lips, but he didn't look up at her. Perhaps I should, but it would be his responsibility to share the news with the country, and I don't think we're ready to draw attention to this. When we have solid evidence that you are as valuable as I hope, then we will share our news with the prince and the world. She picked up a port screen stylus that was lying abandoned on the desk and examined it like a scientific mystery. Twirling it like a pinwheel over her fingers, she murmured, "You also didn't tell him I'm a cyborg." The doctor made eye contact now, his crow's feet crinkling. "Ah, and that is what you're most concerned about?" Before she could confirm or deny, Dr. Erland waved his hand as if to dismiss her defensiveness. "Do you think I should tell him you're a cyborg? I will if you want me to, but I frankly didn't see that was any of his business." Cinder dropped the stylus into her lap. "No, that isn't. I just..." Dr. Erlon snorted. He was laughing at her. Cinder huffed in irritation and glared out the window. The city was almost blindingly bright in the morning sun. "Not like it matters. He'll find out eventually." "Yes, I suppose he will. Especially if he continues to show, interest in you." Dr. Erland pushed his chair back from the desk. "There. Your DNA sequencing has been completed. Shall we make our way to the lab room?" She followed him into the sterile hallway. It was a short walk to the labs, and they entered Lab Room 11D this time, which looked exactly like Lab Room 4D, net screen, built-in cabinets, a single exam table. No mirror. Cinder sat down on the exam table without being told. "I went to the quarantines today, to visit my sister." The doctor paused, his hand on the net screen's power button. "That was something of a risk. You understand that people aren't supposed to leave once they arrive, don't you?" "I know, but I had to see her." She swung her legs, beating her feet against the table's legs. "One of the medroids ran a blood test on me before I left, and I was clear." The doctor fiddled with the net screen's controls. "Indeed. I just thought you should know, in case that might affect something." "It doesn't." He stuck his tongue out the corner of his mouth. A second later, the screen blazed to life. His hands skimmed across the screen, pulling up Cinder's file. It was more complex today, filled with information even she didn't know about herself. "And I saw something," she said. The doctor grunted, more focused on the screen than her. "One of the medroids took an ID chip from a victim after she died. The medroid said it was programmed to take it. It had dozens of them." Dr. Erlon turned back to her with a mildly interested expression. He seemed to ponder this a moment, then his face slowly relaxed. "Well..." "Well what? Why would it do that?" The doctor scratched his cheek, where a fine beard had started to grow across his leathery face. "It's a common practice in rural parts of the world, where lethemosis has been claiming lives for much longer than it has in the cities. The chips are extracted from the deceased and sold off. Illegally, of course, but I understand they can fetch a high price." "Why would anyone want to buy someone else's ID chip?" "Because it's difficult to make a living without one. Money accounts, benefits, licenses, they all require an identity." He stitched his eyebrows. "Although, that brings up an interesting point. With all the lethemosis fatalities the past few years, one would think that the market is saturated with unneeded ID chips."
It is curious that they would still be in demand.
I know, but when you already have one... She paused as his words sank in. Would it really be that easy to steal a person's identity?
Unless you want to become someone else, he said, reading her thoughts. Thieves, fugitives of the law.
The doctor rubbed his head through the hat. The rare lunar. They, of course, do not have ID chips to begin with.
There aren't any lunars on Earth. Well, other than ambassadors, I guess.
Dr. Erlon's gaze filled with pity, as if she were a naive child.
Oh, yes. To Queen Levana's endless dismay, not all lunars are so easily brainwashed into mindless contentment, and many have risked their lives to escape Luna and relocate here. It's difficult to leave the moon, and I'm sure many more die attempting it than succeed, especially as more restrictions are put on lunar ports. But I'm sure it still happens.
But that's illegal. They're not supposed to be here at all. Why haven't we stopped them?
For a moment, it looked as if Dr. Erland might laugh.
Escaping from Luna is difficult. Getting to Earth is the easy part. Lunars have ways of cloaking their spacecrafts and making their way into Earth's atmosphere without detection.
Magic, Cinder fidgeted.
You make it sound like they're escaping from a prison.
Dr. Erland raised both eyebrows at her.
Yes, that seems exactly right.
Cinder kicked her boots against the lab table. The thought of Queen Levana coming to New Beijing had twisted her stomach. The thought of dozens, maybe even hundreds of lunars living on Earth and impersonating Earthens nearly had her running for the sink. Those savages, with a programmed ID chip and their ability to brainwash people. They could be anyone, become anyone. And Earthens would never know they were being manipulated.
Don't look so frightened, Miss Lin. They mostly stick to the countrysides, where their presence is more likely to go unnoticed. The chances that you have ever crossed paths with one is extremely unlikely.
He smiled, a teasing, close-lipped smile. Cinder sat up straighter.
You sure seem to know a lot about them.
I am an old man, Miss Lin. I know a lot about a lot of things.
All right, here's a question. What's with lunars and mirrors? I always thought it was just a myth that they're afraid of them, but is it true?
The doctor's eyebrows knit together.
It has some element of truth. You understand how lunars make use of their glamours?
Not really.
Ah, I see,
he said, rocking back on his heels.
Well, the lunar gift is nothing more than the ability to manipulate bioelectric energy, the energy that is naturally created by all living things. For example, it is the same energy that sharks use to detect their prey.
Sounds like something lunars would do.
The lines around the doctor's mouth crinkled.
Lunars have the unique ability to not only detect bioelectricity in others, but also control it. They can manipulate it so that people see what the lunar wishes them to see, and even feel what the lunar wishes them to feel. A glamour is what they call the illusion of themselves that they project into the minds of others.
Like making people think you're more beautiful than you really are?
Precisely. Or, he gestured at Cinder's hands, making a person see skin where there is really metal.
Cinder self-consciously rubbed her cyborg hand through the glove.
It is why Queen Levana is so striking to look at. Some talented lunars, such as the Queen, keep their glamour up all the time. But just as she cannot trick the net screens, neither can she trick a mirror.
So they don't like mirrors because they don't want to see themselves?
Vanity is a factor, but it's more a question of control. It's easier to trick others into perceiving you as beautiful if you can convince yourself you are beautiful. But mirrors have an uncanny way of telling the truth.
Dr. Erlon peered at her, as if amused.
And now a question for you, Miss Lin. Why the sudden interest in lunars?
Cinder lowered her gaze to her hands and realized she was still carrying the stylus stolen off his desk.
Something Kai said.
His Highness? She nodded.
He told me Queen Lavanna is coming to New Beijing.
The doctor drew back. He gaped at her, bushy eyebrows nearly touching the brim of his hat, then stepped back against the cabinets. For the first time that day, his focus was entirely on her.
When?
She's supposed to arrive today.
Today?
She jumped. She could not have imagined Dr. Erland raising his voice before. He spun away from her, scratching his hat, pondering.
Are you all right?
He waved away the question.
I suppose she would have been waiting for this. He pulled off his hat, revealing a bald spot surrounded by thin, messy hair.
He shuffled his hand through it a few times, glaring at the floor.
She is hoping to prey on Kai, his youth, his inexperience.
He blew out a furious breath and replaced the hat. Cinder splayed her fingers out on her knees.
What do you mean, prey on him?
He turned back to her. His face was pulled taut, his eyes turbulent. The stare he pinned on Cinder made her shrink away.
You should not be worried about the prince, Miss Lin.
I shouldn't?
She is coming today. That is what he told you.
She nodded.
Then you must leave, quickly. You can't be here when she arrives.
He shooed her off the table. Cinder hopped down, but made no move toward the door.
What does this have to do with me?
We have your blood samples, your DNA. We can do without you for now. Just stay away from the palace until she's gone. Do you understand?
Cinder planted her feet.
No, I don't.
The doctor looked from her to the net screen, still showing her stats. He appeared confused, old, frazzled. Screen, display current news feed. Cinder's stats vanished, replaced by a news anchor. The headline above him announced the Emperor's death. Highness is preparing to make a speech in just a few minutes on the death of His Imperial Majesty and the upcoming coronation. We will be broadcasting live.
Mute.
Cinder folded her arms. Doctor? He turned, pleading eyes to Cinder.
Miss Lin, you must listen very carefully.
I'll turn my audio interface volume to max.
She leaned back against the cabinets, disappointed when Dr. Erland didn't so much as blink at her sarcasm. Instead, he blew out a disgruntled sigh.
I am not sure how to say this. I thought I would have more time.
He rubbed his hands together, paced back toward the door, squared his shoulder, and faced Cinder again.
You were 11 when you had your operation, correct?
The question was not what she'd been expecting.
Yes, and before that, you don't remember anything.
Nothing. What does this have to do with...
But your adoptive parents, surely they must have told you something about your childhood, your background...
Her right palm began to sweat. My stepfather died not long after the accident, and Audrey doesn't like to talk about it, if she even knows anything. Adopting me wasn't exactly her idea.
Do you know anything about your biological parents?
Cinder shook her head.
Just their names, birth dates, whatever was in my files.
The files on your ID chip.
Well, irritation burst inside her. What's your point?
Dr. Erlan's eyes softened, trying to comfort, but the look only unnerved her.
Miss Lin, from your blood samples, I have deduced that you are, in fact, lunar.
The word washed over Cinder, as if he were speaking a different language. The machine in her brain kept ticking, ticking, like it was working through an impossible equation.
Lunar?
The word evaporated off her tongue, almost non-existent.
Yes.
Lunar.
Indeed.
She pulled back, looked at the walls, the exam table, the silent news anchor.
I don't have magic, she said, folding her arms in defiance.
Yes, well, not all lunars were born with the gift. They're called shells, which is a slightly derogatory connotation on Luna, so... Well, bioelectrically challenged doesn't sound much better, does it?
He chuckled awkwardly. Cinder's metal hand clenched. She briefly wished she did have some sort of magic so she could shoot a bolt of lightning through his head.
I'm not lunar, She wrenched her glove off and waved her hand at him. I'm cyborg. You don't think that's bad enough?
Lunars can be cyborg as easily as humans. It's rare, of course, given their intense opposition of cybernetics and brain-machine interfaces.
Cinder faked a gasp.
No, who would be opposed to that? But being lunar and being cyborg are not mutually exclusive. And it isn't altogether surprising that you were brought here, since the instatement of the non-gifted infanticide under Queen Chanary, many lunar parents have attempted to rescue their shell children by bringing them to Earth. Of course, most of them die and are executed for the attempt, but still, I believe this was the case with you. The rescuing part, not the execution part.
An orange light flickered in the corner of her vision. Cinder squinted at the man.
You're lying.
I am not lying, Miss Lin. She opened her mouth to argue. Which part? What exactly had he said that triggered the lie detector? The light went away as he continued speaking.
This also explains your immunity. In fact, when you defeated the pathogens yesterday, your being lunar was the first possibility to cross my mind. But I didn't want to say anything until I'd confirmed it.
Cinder pressed her palms against her eyes, blocking out the blaring fluorescence.
What does this have to do with immunity?
Lunars are immune to the disease, of course.
No, not of course. This is not common knowledge.
She strung her hands back against her ponytail.
Oh, well, but it is common sense when you know the history.
He wrung his hands, which I suppose most people don't. Cinder hid her face, gasping for air. Perhaps she could rely on the man being insane and not have to believe anything he said after all.
You see, said Dr. Erland, lunars are the original carrier hosts for lithimosis. Their migration to the rural areas of Earth, mostly during the reign of Queen Chanary, brought the disease into contact with humans for the first time. Historically, it's a common situation. The rats that brought the bubonic plague to Europe, the conquistadors who brought smallpox to Native Americans. It sounds so second era that Earthans take their immunities for granted now, but with the migration of the lunars, well, Earthan immune systems just weren't prepared. Once even a handful of lunars arrived, bringing the disease with them, it began spreading like wildfire.
I thought I wasn't contagious.
You aren't now, because your body has developed means of ridding itself of the disease. But you may have been at one point. Besides, I suspect that lunars have different levels of immunity. While some can rid their bodies of the disease entirely, others carry it around without ever developing outward symptoms, spreading it everywhere they go and being none the wiser of the trouble they're causing.
Cinder waved her hands before him.
No. You're wrong. There's some other explanation. I can't be...
I understand this is a lot to take in, but I need you to understand why you cannot be present when Her Majesty arrives. It's far too dangerous.
No, you don't understand. I am not one of them. To be cyborg and lunar? One was enough to make her a mutant, an outcast. But to be both? She shuddered. Lunars were a cruel, savage people. They murdered their shell children. They lied and scammed and brainwashed each other because they could. They didn't care who they hurt, so long as it benefited themselves. She was not one of them.
Miss Lin, you must listen to me. You were brought here for a reason.
What, to help you find a cure? You think this is some sort of twisted gift of fate?
I am not talking fate or destiny. I am talking survival. You cannot let the Queen see you.
Cinder shrank against the cabinet, more baffled by the second.
Why? Why would she care about me?
She would care very much about you.
He hesitated, his sea-blue eyes wild with panic.
She hates lunar shells, you see. Shells are immune to the lunar glamour.
He twirled his hands through the air, searching. They're brainwashing, as it were.
Queen Levana can't control shells, which is why she continues to have them exterminated.
His lips hardened.
Queen Levana will stop at nothing to ensure her control, to terminate any resistance. That means killing those who could resist her. People like you. Do you understand me, Miss Lin? If she were to see you, she would kill you.
Gulping, Cinder pressed her thumb against her left wrist. She couldn't feel her ID chip, but she knew it was there, extracted from the deceased. If Dr. Erland were right, then everything she knew about herself, her childhood, her parents, was wrong. A made-up history. A made-up girl. The idea that Lunars were fugitives no longer sounded so odd. She turned toward the net screen. Kai was there now, in the press room, talking at the podium.
Miss Lin, someone went through a great deal of trouble to bring you here, and now you are in extreme danger. You cannot jeopardize yourself.
She barely heard, watching as text began to scroll along the bottom of the screen. Just announced, Lunar Queen Levana to come to the Eastern Commonwealth for peace alliance discussions. Just announced, Lunar Queen Levana.
Miss Lin, are you listening to me?
Yeah, she said. Extreme danger. I heard you.
Chapter 20. The lunar spacecraft did not appear much different from Earthen spacecrafts, except that its body shimmered as if inlaid with diamonds, and a string of gold runes encircled its hull in an unbroken line. The ship was too bright in the afternoon sun, and Kai had to squint against the glare. He did not know if the runes were magic, or if they were only meant to seem so. He did not know if the ship was made out of some fancy, glittery material, or if they just painted it that way. He did know it hurt to look at. The ship was larger than the personal shuttle the Queen's head thaumaturge, Sybil, had come to Earth on, and yet still relatively small for all the importance it carried. Smaller than most passenger ships, and smaller than any cargo ship Kai had seen. It was a private ship, meant only for the Lunar Queen and her entourage. The ship landed without a jolt. Heat rose up from the concrete in blistering waves. The fine silk of Kai's shirt was clinging to his back, and a trickle of sweat had begun down his neck. In the evening, the welcome pad would be sheltered by the palace's stone walls, but now it was under full assault by the late August sun. They waited. Torin, at Kai's side, did not fidget. His face was impassive, expectant. His calmness only unsettled Kai even more. On Kai's other side, Sybil Mira stood dressed in her official white coat with its embroidered runes, similar to those on the ship. The material seemed lightweight, yet it covered her from the top of her throat to the knuckles of each hand, and the flared tails hung past her knees. She must have been sweltering, but she looked fully composed. A few steps behind her stood the blonde guard, hands clasped behind his back. Two of Kai's own royal guards stood at either side of the platform. That was all. Levana had insisted that no one else greet her at the pad. Kai dug his nails into his palms in an attempt to keep the sneer from his face, and waited while the heat plastered his bangs to his forehead. Finally, when the Queen seemed to have grown tired of making them suffer, the ramp of the ship descended, revealing silver-furnished stairs. Two men alighted first, both tall, both muscular. One was pale with wildly unkempt orange hair and was dressed in the same warrior-like body armor and weaponry that Sybil's guard wore. The other man was dark as night sky, with no hair at all, and wore a coat like Sybil's, with its bell sleeves and embroidery. His, however, was crimson, announcing that he was beneath Sybil, a second-tier thaumaturge. Kai was glad he knew enough about the lunar court to recognize that, at least. He watched the two men as they surveyed the pad, the surrounding walls, and the assembled group with stoic expressions before standing to either side of the ramp. Sybil slinked forward. Kai swallowed a breath of stifling air. Queen Levana appeared at the top of the stairs. She still wore her long veil, blindingly bright beneath the relentless sun. Her white dress whispered around her hips as she glided down the steps and accepted Sybil's hand. Sybil dipped to one knee and touched her forehead to her queen's knuckle.
Our separation was insufferable. I am pleased to be in your service once more, my queen.
Then she stood, and with a single, graceful motion, lifted the veil back from Lavanna's face. The hot air caught in Kai's throat, choking him. The queen paused just long enough to seem as though she were letting her eyes adjust to the bright daylight of Earth. But Kai suspected she really just wanted him to see her. She was indeed beautiful, as if someone had taken the scientific measurements of perfection and used them to mold a single ideal specimen. Her face was slightly heart-shaped, with high cheekbones barely flushed. Auburn hair fell in silken ringlets to her waist, and her unblemished ivory skin shimmered like mother-of-pearl in the sunshine. Her lips were red, 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 looking like she'd just drunk a pint of blood. A chill shook Kai from the inside out. She was unnatural. Kai risked a glance at Torin and saw that he held Lavanna's gaze without outward emotion. Seeing his advisor's resolve sent a jolt of determination through Kai. Reminding himself that it was only an illusion, he forced himself to look at the queen again. Her onyx eyes glittered as they swept over him. "Your Majesty," Kai said, folding a fist to his heart, "it is my greatest honor to welcome you to my country and planet." Her lips curled. A sweetness lit up her face. An innocence to match a child's. It unsettled him. She did not bow or even nod, but instead held out her hand. Kai hesitated, staring at the pale, translucent skin, wondering if just touching her was all it would take to destroy a man's mind. Bracing himself, he took her hand and brushed a quick kiss against her fingers. Nothing happened.
"Your Highness," she said in a lilting voice that thrummed along Kai's spine, "it is my greatest honor to be thus welcomed. Might I again offer my sincerest condolences on the loss of your father, the great Emperor Raikin?"
Kai knew she was not at all sorry for his father's death, but neither her expression nor her tone hinted at a thing. "Thank you," he replied. "I hope everything meets your expectations during your visit."
"I look forward to the Eastern Commonwealth's famed hospitality."
Sybil stepped forward, eyes respectfully averted from Queen Lavanna.
"I inspected your quarters myself, my queen. They are subpar to our accommodations on Luna, but I think they will be adequate."
Lavanna did not acknowledge her thaumaturge, but her gaze softened, and the world changed. Kai felt that the ground lurched beneath him, that the air had been sucked from the Earth's atmosphere, that the sun had gone black, leaving the ethereal queen the only source of light in the galaxy. Tears pricked at the back of his eyes.
He loved her. He needed her. He would do anything to please her.
He jabbed his fingernails into his palms as hard as he could, nearly yelping from the pain. But it worked. The queen's control disintegrated, leaving only the beautiful woman, not the desperate adoration of her. He knew that she was aware of the effect she had had on him as he struggled to soothe his ragged breathing. And though he wanted to detect cold haughtiness in her black eyes, he saw nothing, nothing at all.
"If you will follow me," he said, his voice slightly hoarse, "I will show you to your rooms."
"That will not be necessary," said Sybil. "I am quite familiar with the guest wing and can take Her Majesty myself. We would like a moment to speak in private."
"Of course," said Kai, hoping that his relief didn't show. Sybil led the way, the second thaumaturge and the two guards marching behind. They paid Kai and Torin no heed as they passed, but Kai didn't doubt they would snap his neck in a second if he made any suspicious movements. He released a shaky breath when they had gone.
"Did you feel her?"
he asked, barely above a whisper.
"Of course,"
said Torin. His eyes were drawn to the ship, but he could have been staring at Mars for all the focus in his eyes.
"You resisted her well, Your Highness. I know it was difficult."
Kai brushed his hair off his forehead, seeking a breeze, any breeze, but it didn't come.
"It wasn't so hard. It was only for a moment."
Torin's eyes met his. It was one of the few times Kai had seen true sympathy in that gaze.
"It will get harder."
Book 3.
"You want to go to the festival all covered in dust and dirt? But we would only be ashamed of you."
Chapter 21. Cinder slumped down at her work desk, relieved to finally be out of that stifling apartment. Not only was the air system down, again, with maintenance nowhere to be seen, but the awkwardness between her and Audrey bordered on unbearable. They'd been tiptoeing around each other since she'd returned home from the lab 2 days before, Audrey trying to remind Cinder of her superiority by ordering her to defrag their apartment's entire mainframe and update all the software that they didn't even use anymore, while at the same time lurking around as if she were almost kind of ashamed of what she'd done to Cinder. But Cinder was probably imagining that last part. At least Pearl had been gone all day and had only shown up when Cinder and Aiko were on their way out to work on the car. Another long day. Another late night. The car was going to take more work than she'd realized. The entire exhaust system needed to be replaced, which meant manufacturing a lot of parts herself, which created any number of headaches. She had a feeling she wasn't going to get much sleep if they were going to have it road ready by the night of the ball. She sighed. The ball. She didn't regret saying no when the prince had asked her, because she knew how badly that would end. Any number of things were sure to go wrong, from tripping on the stairs and flashing the prince a sexy metal thigh, to running into Pearl or Audrey or someone from the market. People would talk. The gossip channels were sure to look into her past, and pretty soon, the whole world would know that the prince had taken a cyborg to his coronation ball. He would be mortified. She would be mortified. But it didn't make it any easier when she wondered, what if she were wrong? What if Prince Kai wouldn't care? What if the world were different and nobody cared if she was cyborg? And on top of that, lunar. Yeah, wishful thinking. Spotting the broken net screen on the carpet, she peeled herself off her chair and kneeled before it. The black screen was just reflective enough for her to see the outline of her face and body, the tanned skin of her arms, contrasted with the dark steel of her hand. Denial had run its course until it had nowhere else to go. She was lunar. But she was not afraid of the mirrored surface. Not afraid of her own reflection. She couldn't understand what Levana and her kind, their kind, found so disturbing about it. Her mechanical parts were the only disturbing thing in Cinder's reflection, and that had been done to her on Earth. Lunar and cyborg. And a fugitive. Did Audrey know? No. Audrey never would have housed a lunar. If she'd known, she would have turned Cinder in herself, probably expecting payment. Had Audrey's husband known? That was a question Cinder would probably never know the answer to. Nevertheless, she was confident that so long as Dr. Erlon didn't say anything, her secret would be safe. She would just have to go on as if nothing had changed. In many ways, nothing had. She was every bit an outcast as ever. A white blob caught her eye in the screen's surface. Kai's android, its lifeless sensor staring down at her from its perch on top of her desk. Its pear-shaped body was the brightest thing in the room,
and probably the cleanest. It reminded her of the sterile medroids in the labs and the quarantines, but this machine did not have scalpels and syringes hidden in its torso. Work. Mechanics. She needed the distraction. Returning to her desk, she turned on her audio interface for some tranquil background music. Kicking off her boots, she gripped both sides of the android and wheeled it toward her. After a quick examination of its external plating, she tipped the android over, laying it horizontal so that it balanced on the edge of its treads. Cinder opened the back panel and inspected the wiring throughout the cylindrical frame. It was not a complicated android. The interior was mostly hollow, a shell for housing a minimum of hard drives, wires, chips. Tudor androids required little more than a central processing unit. Cinder suspected that the android would have to be wiped and reprogrammed, but she had a feeling that wasn't a viable option. Despite Kai's nonchalance, it was clear that this android knew something important, and after their conversation in the research hall, she had an uneasy feeling it had something to do with Lunars. War strategies? Classified communications? Evidence for blackmail? Whatever it was, Kai clearly thought it would help, and he'd trusted Cinder to save it.
No pressure or anything, she muttered, gripping a flashlight between her teeth so she could see inside the android.
She grabbed a pair of pliers and coerced the wires from one side of its cranium to the other. Its configuration was similar to Iko's, so Cinder felt a familiarity with its parts, knew exactly where to find all the most important connections. She checked that the wire connectors were sound, that the battery held power, that no important pieces were missing, and everything seemed fine. She cleaned out the noise translator and adjusted the internal fan, but Nancy the android remained a lifeless statue of plastic and aluminum.
All dressed up with nowhere to go, said Iko from the doorway.
Cinder spit out the flashlight with a laugh and glanced down at her oil-stained cargo pants.
Yeah, right. All I need is a tiara.
I was talking about me.
She spun her chair around. Iko had draped a strand of Audrey's pearls around her bulbous head and smeared cherry lipstick beneath her sensor in a horrible imitation of lips. Cinder laughed.
Wow, that's a great color on you.
Do you think?
Iko wheeled her way into the room and paused before Cinder's desk, trying to catch her reflection in the net screen.
I was imagining going to the ball and dancing with the prince.
Cinder rubbed her jaw with one hand and mindlessly tapped the table with the other.
Funny, I've found myself imagining that exact thing lately.
I knew you liked him. You pretend to be immune to his charms, but I could see the way you looked at him at the market.
Iko rubbed at the lipstick, smearing it across her blank, white chin.
Yeah, well, Cinder pinched her metal fingers with the plier's nose. We all have our weaknesses.
I know, said Iko. Mine is shoes.
Cinder tossed the tool onto her desk. Something like guilt was beginning to grow in her when Iko was around. She knew she should tell Iko about being Lunar, that Iko more than anyone would understand what it was like to be different and unwanted. But somehow, she couldn't bring herself to say it out loud.
By the way, Iko, it turns out I'm Lunar. You don't mind, do you?
What are you doing down here? She asked instead.
Just seeing if you need help. I'm supposed to be dusting the air vents, but Audrey was in the bath.
So?
I could hear her crying.
Cinder blinked.
Oh.
It was making me feel useless.
I see.
Iko was not a normal servant android, but she did retain one prominent trait. Uselessness was the worst emotion they knew.
Well, sure you can help, Cinder said, rubbing her hands together. Just don't let her catch you with those pearls.
Iko lifted the beaded necklace up with her prongs, and Cinder noticed she was wearing the ribbon Peony had given her. She pulled back, as if she'd been stung.
How about some light?
The blue sensor brightened, shedding a spotlight into Nancy's interior. Cinder twisted up her lips.
Do you think it could have a virus?
Maybe her programming was overwhelmed by Prince Kai's uncanny hotness.
Cinder flinched. Can we please not talk about the prince?
I don't think that will be possible. You're working on his android after all. Just think about the things she knows, the things she's seen, and...
Aiko's voice sputtered.
Do you think she's seen him in the nude?
Oh, for heaven's sake. Cinder yanked off her gloves and tossed them onto the table. You're not helping.
I'm just making conversation.
Well, stop. Crossing her arms over her chest, Cinder pushed her chair back from the work table and swung both legs up to rest on top of it.
It has to be a software issue.
She sneered to herself. Software issues usually came down to reinstallation, but that would turn the android into a blank slate. She didn't know if Kai was concerned with the android's personality chip, which had probably developed into something quite complicated after 20 years of service, but she did know Kai was concerned with something in this android's hard drive, and she didn't want to risk wiping whatever it was. The only way to determine what was wrong and if a reboot was necessary was to check the android's internal diagnostics, and that required plugging in. Cinder hated plugging in. Connecting her own wiring with a foreign object had always felt hazardous. Like, if she wasn't careful, her own software could be overridden. Chastising herself for being squeamish, she reached for the panel in the back of her head. Her fingernail caught the small latch and swung it open.
What's that?
Cinder stared at Aiko's outstretched prong.
What's what?
That chip.
Cinder dropped her feet to the floor and leaned forward. She squinted into the far back of the model, where a row of tiny chips stood like soldiers along the bottom of the control panel. There were 20 plugs in all, but only 13 of them were full. Manufacturers always left plenty of room for add-ons and updates. Aiko had spotted the 13th chip, and she was right. Something was different about it. It was tucked far enough behind the other chips that it was easy to miss with a cursory glance. But when Cinder targeted it with the flashlight, it gleamed like polished silver. Cinder shut the panel in the back of her head and called up the digital blueprint of the android's model on her retina. According to the manufacturer's original plans, this model only came with 12 chips. But surely after 20 years, the android would have received at least one add-on. Surely the palace had access to the newest, finest programs available. Still, Cinder had never seen a chip quite like this. She pressed a fingernail into the release switch and gripped the edge of the silver chip with the pliers. It slid like grease from its plug. Cinder held it up for closer inspection. With the exception of the pearlescent, shimmering finish, it looked like every other program chip she'd ever seen. Flipping it over, she saw the letters DCOM engraved on the other side.
Is that so?
She lowered her arm.
What is it?
Asked Aiko.
A direct communication chip.
Cinder furrowed her brow. Almost all communication was done through the net. Direct communication that bypassed the net entirely was practically obsolete, as it was slow and had a tendency to lose connection in the middle of a link. She supposed paranoid types who required absolute privacy would find direct comms appealing, but even then, they would use a port or net screen, a device that was set up for it. Using an android as one side of the link didn't make any sense.
Aiko's light dimmed.
My database informs me that androids have not come equipped with direct communication abilities since 89 TE.
Which would explain why it didn't work with her programming. Cinder held the chip toward Aiko. Can you run a material scan? See what it's made out of? Aiko backed away.
Absolutely not. Having a mental breakdown is not on my list of things to do today.
It doesn't seem like it would have caused her to malfunction, though. Wouldn't the system have just rejected it? Cinder angled the chip back and forth, mesmerized by how its reflective surface caught Aiko's light. Unless she tried to send information over the direct link.
It could have jammed up the bandwidth. Standing, she strolled across the storage space toward the net screen. Though its frame had been shattered, the screen and controls seemed undamaged. She slid the chip in and pressed the power button, having to jab it harder than usual before a pale green light came to life beside the drive and the screen flared bright blue. A spiral in the corner announced that it was reading the new chip. Cinder released her breath and folded her legs beneath her. A second later, the spiral disappeared, replaced with text. Initiating direct link with unknown user, please wait. Initiating direct link with unknown user, please wait. Initiating direct link with unknown user, please wait. Cinder waited, and wiggled her foot, and waited, and drummed her fingers against her knee.